We continue our journey through the Bible. Lord willing, tonight we will conclude the section of the Bible that is called poetry. We have completed about 66% of the Old Testament. The history and the poetry sections are done. All we have left is the prophecy section that we will start next week, Isaiah to Malachi. Song of Solomon, if you remember, there are two views to this song. There's two ways to take this song. Remember that it is a song. First of all, it is poetry. It is a song. And one of the views, they make Solomon the beloved. And the other view is a poor shepherd is the beloved. The first time we took Song of Solomon, we took the view that Solomon is the beloved, but now we are taking the other view. Solomon is trying to get the Shulamite woman, but she is faithful to her beloved, who is a poor, simple shepherd. So chapter 6 deals with the beauty of the bride. And there's two simple parts in that chapter. Where is he? Verses 1 to 3. And who is she? Verses 4 to 13. So Solomon is the writer and he says, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Whereas your beloved turned aside, that we may seek him with you. My beloved has gone to his garden, to the beds of spices, to feed his flock in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He feeds his flock among the lilies." So the Jerusalem maiden were puzzled by the description of the perfect man that they had just heard from her. Remember chapter 10, verses 10 to 16, she was giving a description of this man. And they wanted to see this beauty. So they asked, sort of sarcastically, where they might find him in verse 1, implying that she might not even know herself. So the Shulamite's answer is purposely vague and evasive. She said he has gone to his garden, verse 2. Why should she tell them? She belongs to him and he belongs to her, she says in verse 3. And that's the way she intended it to remain. Her statement of mutual possession is the reverse of her earlier declaration. If you remember in chapter 2, verse 16, she says, "He is mine and I am his." So while separated by distance and circumstances, the Shulamite was confident of two things. Number one, she loved this shepherd. And number two, he loved her. Other women may choose to chase after him all they wanted. She was confident in her relationship to him. So that's the first part. Where is he? Now at chapter verse 4, we start the second part. Who is she? So the song continues and says, "Oh my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn your eyes away from me, for they have overcome me. Your hair is like a flock of goat going down from Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep which have come up from the washing. Everyone bears twins, and none is barren among them. Like a piece of pomegranate are your temples behind your veil. There are 60 queens, 80 concubines, and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, the favorite of the one who bore her. The daughter saw her and called her blessed. The queens, the concubines, and they praise her. Who is she who looks forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, awesome as an army with banners? So the beloved here in one view is Solomon trying to woo her one more time, or in the second view that we are taking, the beloved is the shepherd. In this section, the beloved did two things. He characterized the beauty of the Shulamite in verses 4 to 7, and then he contrasted the beauty of the Shulamite in verses 8 to 10. Now, Tirzah and Jerusalem were regarded by the Israelite as the two most beautiful cities of the land. So they are used in verse 4, those two cities, as symbols of the surpassing beauty of this woman, the Shulamite. Her beauty was overwhelming, overpowering like an army with flying banners going forth to victory. The beloved begged the maiden to look away from him in verse 5. He felt helpless to withstand the gaze of her eyes. Her looks made it impossible for him to look to her. He was melting. The comment about her hair being like a flock of goats in verse 5, her teeth being like a newly washed sheep, verse 6, and her temple or her cheeks behind the veil being like a slice of pomegranate in verse 7, is a repetition of the comparison that was made earlier in chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. So this is just simply a repeat. Then she is compared to the other members of the harem in verse 8. Other women, the concubine, the queen, the virgin, she's compared to them. And this setting must have been during the earlier reign of Solomon before he reached the number 300 of wives and the number 700 of concubines that we see in 1 Kings chapter 11 verse 3. Here there was only 60 and 80. But then he speed up and he was able to get more of them. He was trying to get this one, but he never got that one. There were only 60 wives and 80 concubines at that time. But still the Shulamite exceeded all these women in beauty and in purity. This is where a woman is rare, when she exceeds in purity. She was her mother's only child, verse 9. Just as she stood out in her family as the favorite of her mother, so she stood out here as unique among the women of the palace. Only child should be only female child, because we will see later that she had brothers, and brothers who kind of mocked her, but she was her mother's only female child. Her innocence, her modesty, her purity were qualities that attracted men to her. And these same three qualities, innocence, modesty, and purity, still attract men today. I would say Christian men. Because of her stunning beauty and excellent moral qualities, this Shulamite was admired by all the women of the harem in verse 9. They praised her. She was special. She was quite a woman. Verse 10 is the praise that was directed towards the Shulamite. Now, Solomon, the writer of this song, remember, this is something to sing. They were singing this thing. Here he is quoting the reaction of the court ladies when they first laid their eyes on the Shulamite. The first figure refers to the rising sun breaking through the covers of night on the eastern horizon. She was as pretty as the dawn of the day, as beautiful as the moon, and as awesome as an army. Verse 11, the song continues, says, I went down to the garden of nuts to see the verdure of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded and the pomegranate had bloomed. Before I was even aware, my soul had made me and the chariot of my noble people. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you. What would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the double camp. In these three verses, the Shulamite explains to the ladies the unexpected way in which she was brought to the palace. She had been busy with her chores on the farm that fateful day, checking on the family gardens and the vineyards, verse 11. And suddenly she found herself swept away by the royal entourage that was passing by. Remember, Solomon was there in all of his splendor with all of his bed that they were carrying him. We saw that earlier. And she is saying here that what happened. She was swept away in no time. She seems to be reproaching herself for having allowed her curiosity to draw her too near to the escort of the king, who was on an outing in the neighborhood where she lived. She acknowledged that she had brought her predicament upon herself. She was not taken violently. She had been impressed by the spectacle, and momentarily she had been charmed by the attention of the king. In verse 12, before I was even aware, my soul had made me and the chariots of my noble people. It was nothing she had planned or even desired, but it happened, and she was taken to by the king. As she started to leave, either Solomon or the daughters of Jerusalem and friends, they called her back for another look at her beauty. Verse 13, return, return, we want to see you again. But she asked why they wanted to look on anyone as ordinary as her. For the first time in the poem, in the song, the maiden is identified regionally as the Shulamite. That is one from Shulam. The Shulamite responded with charming modesty. She had no clue how beautiful she really was. Someone said, when you know you are beautiful, look again, maybe you're not. She did not think she was beautiful, and she was. The last line in the verse is difficult. The two camps that the Shulamite mentioned may well be a dance in which two different groups, two camps, two groups of dancers weaved in and out with one another. So the main lesson of this chapter 6 is, do God's people today impress the world with their beauty or with their Christ-likeness? Someone said, beauty is skin deep, but ugliness is to the bone. So show the world your Christ-likeness, not your temporary beauty. Inner beauty will last forever. Outer beauty, just a short time. Don't get hooked on it. It will not be there long. Chapter 7. Chapter 7 deals with a further description of the beauty of this woman, who will be the bride. Shortly, this thing ends with a wedding. And this chapter can be divided into two parts. We see the admiration for her in verses 1 to 9. And we see the acclamation that is made in verses 10 to 13. So Solomon continues his song. Remember, he wrote over 1,000 of them. This is the only one we have. And he says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter! The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hand of a skilled workman. Your navel is a rounded goblet, which lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a pile of wheat, set about with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower, your eyes like the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bat Rabim. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, which looked towards Damascus. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. The king is held captive by its tresses." So again, there are two views concerning these five verses. Who is saying these things? Some say that they are spoken by the beloved, the shepherd, to his wife-to-be. Others say that they are spoken by the ladies of the court. Remember, in a previous chapter, they were amazed by this girl. They really admire her beauty. They ask her, "We want come again. We want to take a second look." So most likely, they were spoken by the ladies of the court, the ladies of the palace. Taking them as spoken by the beloved does not change anything. You can choose whichever view you like without changing a thing. But most likely, keeping the context of the previous chapter, most likely they were spoken by the ladies of the court. To them, the Shulamite appeared noble, royal, and beautiful beyond description. For this reason, they addressed her not as a country girl like she was, but as a prince's daughter, verse 1. You gotta be royalty the way you look. You are from a prince. The women started with her feet, and they praised her beauty all the way to her head. And they mentioned 10 things about this young girl. Number one, they started with her feet in verse 1. The beautiful footwear, the sandals, added to the loveliness of her feet. We do not usually think of feet as being an attractive parts of the body, but our Lord wants us to have beautiful feet, spiritually speaking. Beautiful feet carry the gospel of salvation, the Bible says. So our feet should be clean. Jesus washed the feet of his disciples in John 13. They should be covered. First thing the father of the prodigal did in Luke 15:22 is he got sandals and he put sandals on his son's feet. Also Ephesians 6 verse 15, talking about the armor of God, tells us to have our feet shod, it says, covered with the gospel of peace. So they should be busy carrying the good news of salvation. Isaiah 52 verse 7 said that. Even Paul in Romans 10:15. Defiled feet and disobedient feet grieve our Father's heart and make it difficult for him to fellowship with us as he desires to. So that was the first thing they talk about, her feet. Then they moved up to her thighs, also in verse 1. Their curves were like jewels, the work of the hand of an artist. I don't think they meant cellulite, but they compared the swinging to and fro of the ornaments made in the chains. Remember, this is poetry. It's not something that I tried to figure out what the thing moving on her thighs, but I could only think of cellulite. But anyway, but it was not that. Then number three, going up again in verse 2, they talk about her navel. They said it was like a round 6 ounce goblet. No, I don't know how many. I'm kidding. That never lacked mixed wine. The round goblet is intended to convey the shape of a lovely body. It was not a belly button that was sticking out, not an elongated. It was a nice, beautiful round navel. Her belly moved gracefully as in a dance. The navel was regarded by these people as the center of the body. And then also in verse 2, they move a little bit up her belly. They say it was a pile of wheat set about with lilies. They were well arranged in the field, those lilies. On top of the piles, these lilies move in the wind, and that would discourage the bird from coming. And so her belly was beautiful. Such things were regarded as a beautiful sight in an agricultural society like they were. The smooth, round, fair body of the maiden seemed to be an advantage in the various movement of her den. So the way she walked and all, she looked very pretty. Then, and also in verse 3, now going up, they talk about her two breasts. They were like two young deer that are twins of a gazelle. Either the beloved had used, remember earlier, the beloved used similar language when we were in chapter 4, verse 5. He referred to her breasts as twins of a gazelle. And this praise comes from the lips of the palace ladies here. And as mentioned when we were in chapter 4, verse 5, young deer speaks of frailty, beauty. He's not referring to size, huge like two gazelle. So, poetry again. Then in verse 4, they move up to her neck. And her neck was like the Tower of Ivory. The palace ladies echoed the previous praise of the beloved. He had said that in chapter 4, verse 4. The ivory tower was a well-known landmark in the area. The comparison is obvious. Her neck is slender. It is dazzling white in appearance, striking and appealing. Not like a wood stove pipe. It was a nice neck. Then her eyes, also in verse 4, they were as the pools of Heshbon, located in the region known as Moab. Like those refreshing pools, her eyes were inviting and they were clear as spring of water. Then also in verse 4, they going up, her nose was like the Tower of Lebanon that looked towards Damascus. Does not mean that it was long and pointed nose, but her nose conveyed dignity, majesty, inspiring with awe, like the Tower of Lebanon. And facing towards Damascus means the tower in the northeastern wall of the city. They identify a specific tower that really was majestic. Then her head in verse 5 was like Mount Carmel. Carmel was considered the most beautiful area. The meaning is the beautiful shape of her head upon her neck, one of the most attractive characteristics of personal beauty. And then the last one, number 10, also in verse 5, was her hair. Her hair was like purple. Does not say it was purple, it was like purple. The purple shellfish was found near Carmel. And the thought is that the locks of her hair were a shiny purple color. The black looked like purple as it catches the rays of light as she turned. Then verse 6. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delight. This stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breast like its clusters. I said I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of its branches. Let now your breast be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apple, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine. So, now the suitor is listening to the lady, he's talking, he's watching the whole thing, and he's getting excited by the sight of this girl and by the comment made by the ladies. And he addressed the Shulamite directly, and he says five things to her. Number one, he expressed his general delight with her in verse 6. How beautiful and attractive you are, my love, with all your charms. And then he praised her stature in verse 7. It was like a palm tree, pretty tall. The palm tree was selected on account of its elegance. It was commonly used in Eastern poetry as the symbol of love. And then also in verse 7, he admired her breasts. They were like the cluster of that palm tree, beautiful. A golden yellow cluster of fruit crowned the top of the stem. And such clusters impart beauty to the tree, especially when it is seen in the evening twilight. Then he got excited in verse 8. He wanted to climb up the palm tree to take hold of the branches. So the suitor shared with her to what heights he would be willing to go to obtain her love. He would climb to the moon if necessary. And then in verse 8, he commented on her breath. The fragrance of her breath was like apples, refreshing and sweet. No garlic, no onion smell. Beautiful breath. And then finally, in verse 9, he delighted in her mouth. It was like the best wine. Her speech was sweeter to him than the finest wine. What a sweet talker. Flattery will get you anywhere, but it did not work with this girl. There's a bad break in the middle of verse 9. Starting in the middle of the verse, we have the response of the Shulamite. So she says here in the middle of verse 9, the wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers. I am my beloved's, and his desire is towards me. Come, my beloved, let us go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let us get up early to the vineyard. Let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner, new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. So the bad break indicates one more time that the Shulamite may have interrupted the flatteries of Solomon. He was still talking when she interrupted him. She finished his sentence by letting him know that her wine is not for him. It is for her beloved. Her mouth may be like the best wine, but only her beloved will taste it, not him. The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, she said in the second part of verse 9. And then she did four things. Number one, she expressed her love for him, for that poor shepherd. and expressed her confidence in his love for her in verse 10. The comment of mutual possession was already made twice in chapter 2, verse 16, and tonight, chapter 6, verse 3. However, the statement here, my beloved is mine, is replaced by his desire is towards me. This is a stronger way to state possession. How much more can a man belong to a woman than for him to desire only her and no one else? So this is a direct and final rejection of the wooing of the rich king. None can separate her from her beloved, verse 10. She belongs to her shepherd, not to the king. Even as she said it, she knew that the shepherd was longing for her. So that's the first thing that she did. She expressed her love for this shepherd. Then number 2, verse 11, she invited her beloved on an excursion to the country. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the field. Let us lodge in the villages. She would rather go to the villages with her poor beloved than go to the palace in Jerusalem with King Solomon. Number 3, she asked him to join her in her daily responsibilities. Verse 12, let us get up early and go to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine has budded in its blossom, if they have opened, and the pomegranate, if they have bloomed. Then number 4, also in verse 12, she promised to give him her love. There I will give you my love, she said. There in the country, she would serve him with the new and the old fruit that she had been keeping for him, mandrakes and pleasant fruit, verse 13. Fruits were stored on shelves and in cupboards above doorways where they were left to dry and they were out of reach. So she assured her beloved that she had put away all the good things for him to enjoy in verse 13. So the main lesson of this chapter 7 is the bride of Christ bears the image of the King of Kings. The believer should rejoice in his relationship with him and rejoice in the thought that the King of Kings desires him. It is quite an honor for us to be desired by the King of Kings. And finally, chapter 8, the last chapter of the book of poetry. This chapter deals with the continuation of the response of the Shulamite. And it's a bad break. It continues all the way to verse 4. And it can be divided into two parts. Enduring love, verses 1 to 7. And evolving love, verses 8 to 14. So, verse 1, the Shulamite is simply continuing what she said in verse 13 of the previous chapter. Oh, that you were like my brother, who nursed at my mother's breast. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you. I would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to instruct me. I would cause you to drink of spiced wine, of the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it passes. So the Shulamite is speaking here. If the shepherd whom she loved were only her brother, she could kiss him and nobody would despise her for doing that in verse 1. She would take him to her mother's house and she would serve him the choicest spiced wine made of pomegranate in verse 2. And apparently in her home, the course of true love did not run smoothly. There were too many prying eyes, too many restrictions. If the beloved had been her brother, their companions would have been freer and less restricted. She longed to sink into his arm, in verse 3, and be held by him. Let his left hand be under my head. Let his right hand embrace me. Wishful thinking, she's thinking out loud. What joy she would experience in the arms of her beloved. She did not want this fantasy to be disrupted. So for the third time, like she did in chapter 2, verse 7, and in chapter 3, verse 5, she reminded the daughters of Jerusalem that true love cannot be aroused by others. She said, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases, in verse 4. And then verse 5 to 7, who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I awaken you under the apple tree. There your mothers brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement, most fierce flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. So in her home village, the local people saw her returning and asked who it was coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved, in verse 5. What a contrast to her arrival in Jerusalem we saw in chapter 3, verse 6. She was carried by the magnificent royal palanquin, you know, that bed that four people carry. And she was surrounded by the royal bodyguards. Now she is hurrying home. She had found him taking a nap under an apple tree that she had sort of made that place their special place. And that tree was near the house where she had been born, verse 5. In the east, it is possible for childbirth to take place in the open air. It was not uncommon. Today, are you kidding? Come on, honey. Under the cherry tree. That would never happen. But now that she had found him, her only wish was to be with him forever. Set me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, she says in verse 6. She longed to be constantly near him, never to be separated. Seals were suspended from the neck of a woman with a cord. Men generally wore a signet, a ring on the right hand, but ladies, they had those seals that they had around their neck. I don't know what happened. Things have changed a lot. Now the woman has nice ring on her hand, and the man got a cord around his neck. So the Shulamite celebrated the strength of her love that had made her victorious. For love is as strong as death, she says. Love is as irresistible as death, which no one can overcome. Its zeal should be zeal and not jealousy, like it says here. The zeal of love is as cruel as the grave. Love motivates a zeal that completely enslaves a person. It is as powerful as fire that consumes everything. So love is, they say, love is more powerful than the police. I used to remember when I was young. But indeed, true love is like a most violent flame, verse 6. The flame of true love cannot be extinguished by external forces. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the flood overflow it, she says. True love cannot be purchased, she adds in verse 7. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. She is hinting here. True love is unconquerable. It is unpurchasable. With all the riches that Solomon had, he could not buy her love. It belonged to her beloved. This verse is the climax of the book. In her own experience, the Shulamite had demonstrated the truth stated in verse 7. She had remained faithful to her beloved. And then verse 8, we have the second part, the evolving love. We have a little sister and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. So at her mother's house, the Shulamite speaks with her brothers who had been responsible for raising her. Apparently, her father was dead. There's no mention of him anywhere in the song. So she reminded them of what they used to say about her when she was approaching puberty. She has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister on the day that she is spoken for, in verse 8, on her wedding day? And they specified that their generosity would depend on her virtue. What are we going to do with our sister when she gets married? When they first discussed this matter, she was not yet of marriage age. To be spoken for means to be of marriage age. A marriage request has been received. She was spoken for. So the family decided to adjust their actions to the character of the girl in verse 9. If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. The thought is that the young lady would be crowned with honor and wealth if she maintained her virginity. If she is a wall, they would help her to remain pure. And they, when she's spoken for, when she's getting married, they know a beautiful gift that they're going to give for her. On the other hand, if she is a door, you know what a door is. It's open in and out. So they say, we will enclose her. We will barricade her with planks of cedar. Solitary confinement for her own protection. A door is a female who is flirtatious and improper and irresponsible in her relations with men. So should their sister go that direction, she would face family shame and even slavery because they had the right to sell the kids for slavery. And in verses 10 to 12, the Shulamite, she responds. She said, I am a wall and my breasts like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring forth its fruit, 1,000 pieces of silver. My own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who keep its fruit, 200. So the Shulamite claimed moral excellence in verse 10. I was a wall, my breast like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who find peace. She had kept herself pure, and her love was pure. And her beloved knew that. She was now mature. She was ready for marriage. She never gave in to temptation of wine or wealth or fame or flattery. Her unyielding love, chastity, loyalty brought her peace. And it brings peace to anybody who remains loyal and chaste. So the Shulamite finally settled her account with Solomon. The king owned a large vineyard in a place called Baal Hamon. The exact location is not known. And he leased it out to tenants, verse 11. And it brought the king large revenues. And each tenant was to pay him 1,000 pieces of silver for the fruit of the vineyard. And this valuable vineyard is mentioned as an example of the enormous wealth that had been used to tempt the Shulamite to yield to Solomon. Perhaps it had been even offered to her family as the bride gift in exchange for the Shulamite's hand in marriage. But the Shulamite rejected the offer of the vineyard. The king could continue to extract those huge revenues from his vineyard. The Shulamite had her own vineyard, verse 12. My own vineyard is before me, referring to her own person, figuratively speaking, as a vineyard. However modest in comparison with Solomon's 1,000 vineyard, but it was entirely hers. It had not been rented out to others. The point is that her love was not for sale. She had remained loyal to her shepherd, despite the glittering temptations to become Solomon's bride. And then finally, the last two verses, 13 and 14, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions, listen for your voice. Let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved. And be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So the shepherd finally speaks, and he addressed the Shulamite as you who dwell in the gardens, verse 13. And the expression, the companions listen for your voice, let me hear it, is not easy to explain. There are three views of people trying to explain this expression. Some say that the beloved shepherd was asking the Shulamite for a song. You good, you can sing, you have a beautiful voice, let me hear it. Others say that the beloved was asking to hear some of her experience in the palace. You had quite an experience when you were taken to the palace. Tell me, let me hear about it. And still others, like William MacDonald, believe that in the presence of witnesses, the shepherd was asking her to commit herself to him in marriage and to say, I do. I want to hear you. I want to hear you say, I do. And I like this third explanation. So the Shulamite responded to his request with mysterious words, difficult to understand. In figurative, poetic language, she told her beloved to make haste to claim her at his own. Yes, I want to be yours. And you wanted to hear my voice? Here it is. Yes, I do. I want to be your wife. The mountains of spices, verse 14, refers to the pleasures of love in general. And so the story in the book of poetry closes with their wedding. The story has been called the Old Testament endorsement of monogamy in the face of the most blatant example of polygamy found in the scriptures. It is a powerful plea to Israel of Solomon's day to return to the God-given idea of love and marriage. So the main lesson is only those who in sincerity call Christ their beloved and desire him to return for his second coming. Those who are really sincere and they call Christ their beloved, they should be excited for his second coming. So believers should long for it and pray for it and even work for it. So this is the end of the Song of Solomon. This is the end of the portion called poetry in the Bible. Next week, we will start the last section of the Bible that is called prophecy. So you can read Isaiah chapter 1 and chapter 2. The one thing that stands out for me tonight is about marriage. Marriage should be monogamous. Marriage should be permanent. And marriage should be self-giving. Both spouses should be devoted and committed to each other and take delight in each other. And it's not happening much anymore. And marriage left and right are collapsing. Even Christian home, Christian marriage are falling apart because they are not devoted to one another. They're not committed to one another. They do not take delight in each other. They're only me, myself, and I. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one, God said, Genesis 2. So the physical attractiveness of a man and a woman for each other and the fulfillment of those longings in marriage are natural and they are honorable. Moral purity before marriage is commanded by God. Premarital sex has no place in God's plans. So faithfulness before and after marriage is expected and is honored. So may the Lord be with you. May the Lord bless each and every one of you. May He bless your home, bless your work starting tomorrow. May He bless your marriage relationship. May He guide you and help you into loving one another, committing to one another, and being devoted to one another. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.